Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Joel and Chaz's Excellent $200 Million Adventure. How Chaz Felix and Joe Colopy took Bronto Software from a home-based startup to a blockbuster exit. And that's the headline on the front page. The article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, Bronto joins the Triangle Graduation Club. And this article is written by Lauren Onasorge. It started over two pints of Guinness in Durham's Brightleaf Square 13 years ago and ended April 23 with $200 million. Joe Colopy, then a 31-year-old teaching himself how to code from his den, was drinking with Chaz Felix, a recent UNC Kenan Flagler Business School graduate who had just been laid off from their mutual connection, Red Hat. Colopy, an MBA graduate, had been in marketing. Felix had been in business development. That night, they'd each pony up $5,000, forming the partnership behind Bronto Software, an email marketing company that, despite its lack of profitability, would snag clients such as Armani Exchange and Gander Mountain, and would eventually attract a $200 million buyout from California tech giant NetSuite. For many entrepreneurs in the Triangle, Bronto's sale may exemplify their own final mission, build a company for an eventual buyout. But a closer look at the birth and survival of the 13-year-old enterprise offers a lesson of cost control, razor-sharp focus on paying customers, and building the company by recirculating the sale proceeds back into the company. What may come as a surprise is that even today, Bronto's operations lose money. NetSuite CFO Ron Gill says Bronto's operation are expected to reduce the California outfit's operating cash flow by $2 million to $3 million in 2015. But operating income is not what NetSuite is buying. NetSuite is buying access to Bronto's blue-chip customers and upsell them by bundling its own e-commerce products. So how exactly does one build a company from $10,000? Most of the answers lie in the grit, arrogance, and persistence of Colopy, Felix, and their technology and engineering team. Lean and hungry years. Colopy left Red Hat around the time Felix took his job at the open source giant. He met Felix at UNC while he was speaking on an alumni panel. Colopy and Felix shared entrepreneurial ambitions. Felix worked on a business plan while at UNC and subsequently started a venture called Steel Sun. But that venture, as ventures statistically do, busted, a casualty of the 2000.com bubble. So Felix went to work at Red Hat while waiting for his life to change. And Colopy started his own project out of his suburban Durham home. Their acquaintance was casual, neither predicting the long journey they were about to begin. Colopy's dabbling was initially a non-specific venture, one he looks back on as a science fair project to learn to be a developer. With no specific pain point in mind and no applicable computer programming skills, just the drive to create his own product, he poured his savings into his ambitions. Colopy was used to having no money. After all, following his Harvard graduation in 1993, he'd joined the Peace Corps, following that up with a stint at an even less lucrative career as an English teacher in Ecuador. Then Colopy trekked from his hometown in Northeast Ohio to Durham with just his wife, his student loans, and his ambitions, planning to find a campsite. All he knew about Durham was that it housed Duke University. Our aptitude for adventure and everything goes was really, really high, he recalls. From a cheap hotel near Highway 55, the campsite was closed, thankfully, he says. They found an apartment in the Trinity neighborhood, the same area where, in 1999, he would buy the $160,000 house he still lives in. Colopy went to grad school, then took a job at Red Hat. But the game plan since college had been to go all in on his own venture. Leaving Red Hat was the first step to making that bet a reality, but he still needed a partner. As it turns out, Felix would soon need a job. Getting traction. In 2001, with a baby on the way, Colopy knew he had to get serious, so he doubled down on pitching the email product he was just starting to develop. "I always felt when I was really under the gun, I would somehow connect the dots," he says. He started getting beta customers, and he started telling his friend Felix that Red Hat should be using Bronto. Felix, who had grown up in a scrappy household with parents who worked at a publishing company out of their house, one was a writer at one end of the house, the other was an accountant, had a failed business plan under his belt. Steel Sun, the real-time search engine for chat rooms, could have been the next Twitter, he says with a wry smile. Its failure sent him into a sober period where he appreciated the corporate stability of Red Hat. But after 10 months in special projects, Felix got his pink slip when Red Hat laid off more than 10% of its staff following a poor earnings report. Felix was on his own. While he always nurtured the entrepreneurship bug he inherited from his parents, he can't say for sure whether he would have ever taken the entrepreneurship leap if things had been different. "I had a nice paying job," says Felix, now 43 and Bronto's COO. "I was at a good company, but I did really see that as a chapter I wanted to go through." As he was mulling an offer to work at Apple in San Francisco, his friend Colopy invited him over for beers at the James Joyce in Durham on a Friday afternoon in 2002. Over a Guinness, a partnership, a $10,000 investment, and a business emerged. The next day, the pair went to a Durham surplus store and bought desks to set up in Colopy's den. About $3,000 of that initial coffer went toward buying a Macintosh computer on eBay. When a crying baby made the den too loud for sales calls, they moved into their first office space, above where Parker and Otis serves coffee today. They were basically squatting in the $100 per month space, which had a phone that couldn't receive calls. Colopy, now CEO, 44, who named Bronto after his childhood obsession with paleontology, says his marketing background helped him prioritize the brand early with that dinosaur silhouette, even before customers flocked to the concept. The pair rationed what little cash they had scrounged up, paying a hotly negotiated $1,000 for the domain name Bronto.com. Felix got a roommate and initiated a ramen noodle diet as the pair committed to a salary-less life. Colopy foregoed luxuries like new cars, choosing to keep driving the 1988 Acura. "I didn't wear my seatbelt because I thought it would be safer," he jokes, subsisting off of his wife's salary as an environmental researcher in RTP. For Colopy, it was 3 years from Red Hat to his first Bronto paycheck, which was more in line with fast food worker than that of a technology executive. Little by little, traction was building. The late Dave Murray's public relations firm, Clear Image, was the first company to take a chance on Bronto, and client after client followed. Bronto went from leveraging minimally paid interns to hiring actual salaried employees. Several moves and several hundred hires later, and Bronto now counts global brands such as Armani Exchange, Gander Mountain, and Samsonite as clients, and boasts 260 employees. From Brightleaf Square to a windowless closet in Regis near Red Hat's old location, to the expanded 80,000-square-foot campus at American Tobacco, where it was the first real corporate tenant, it's grown its footprint. But while the cloud-based platform's automation technology that helps retailers run email marketing and cross-channel marketing campaigns, has proven profitable for its client companies, it's yet to be profitable in-house, even as Bronto grows internationally with new offices in London and Australia. Finally, a deal. Based on NetSuite's future guidance and Bronto's previous disclosures, Bronto's annual sales are running at more than $40 million. In essence, NetSuite paid about 5 times revenue for the Durham company. Colopy points to recent exits in the space as justifying the high valuation, deals such as Oracle's buy of Responsys. NetSuite, a longtime partner, approached Bronto about the deal. "We were not for sale," says Colopy. "It was a series of conversations," he says, "a marriage of like-minded philosophies. And NetSuite, according to executive earnings statements, was attracted to the talent and headcount, not just the client list. It's likely Colopy and Felix will reap the bulk of the benefits, as there are no institutional backers to claim a piece of the returns. Colopy won't detail the breakdown of his partnership with Felix. What we decided over the Guinnesses stays over the Guinnesses, he says. A ripple effect. Their scrappy garage entrepreneur roots are the real story, their friends say, not just the payout. Friend and entrepreneurship watcher Zach Mansfield, vice president of technology banking at Bronto's Durham neighbor, Square One Bank, and others speak of the pair in the same way that some tout folklore heroes. That's awesome to have a story that's woven together in the whole Durham Renaissance, he says. It's a story that can only encourage an entrepreneurship community where, despite recent exits of Bronto, Appia, and Digital Smiths, top dollar deals have been anything but commonplace. Each deal signed propels the Triangle's entrepreneurship status as well as its visibility, says Joan Seifert Rose, president of the CED in Durham. The momentum in activity, in exit activity, has been great for the region because it helps us build toward a self-sustaining community of serial entrepreneurs, available capital, and deeper talent pool, she says. Colopy doesn't call the $200 million buyout package an exit. He calls it a graduation. We're not finished, he smiles, repeating claims his soon-to-be new boss, NetSuite CEO Zach Nelson, made to investors during a recent earnings call that Bronto will keep growing in Durham. Colopy and Felix have signed employment agreements to stay on, but won't detail the terms. They both say they're committed to Bronto, but it's clear that the entrepreneurship spark first kindled over beers 13 years ago is still very much alive. They won't say if they plan to invest any of the spoils into the startup community, but their history of mentorship indicates Triangle Entrepreneurs and Durham won't be forgotten. It's home, Colopy says. And along with this article, there's also a section, a graph called Bronto Software's Timeline. 2002, Bronto is incorporated, moves from CEO Joe Colopy's Durham house to an office space in Brightleaf Square. 2003, Bronto moves to a closet-like space near Felix and Colopy's old stomping ground, Red Hat. 2004, Bronto announces it is into 1,600 square feet of space at American Tobacco Campus in Durham, has 7 employees, 140 clients. 2006, Bronto reports $3.1 million in revenue, but sees a setback as an update filled with bugs had Bronto offering its service free for a month. 2007, company reports 650 clients, 25 employees, projects $3.5 million in revenue. 2009, anticipates $7 million in annual revenue, reports 54 employees. 2010, has 66 employees. 2011, expands again at American Tobacco Campus, has 118 employees. 2012, opened London office, has 152 employees. 2013, expands at American Tobacco Campus, enters InterSouth Partners' old space, is now at 40,000 square feet, has 173 employees. 2014, opens office in Sydney, Australia, has 216 employees. 2014, announces its doubling space at ATC to 80,000 square feet. And in 2015, NetSuite announces it's buying Bronto. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Rebecca Troyer. A grand North Carolina welcome to Japanese Prime Minister. North Carolina Secretary of State Elaine Marshall attended the White House arrival ceremony on April 28, welcoming Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe to the United States. President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama hosted the ceremony on the South Lawn of the White House. Secretary Marshall was there in two capacities. First, to welcome the Prime Minister as President of the National Association of Secretaries of State. and second, to lead a delegation of supporters for business and industrial ties between Japan and North Carolina. The North Carolina delegation included Rocky Iwashima, president of the Nippon Club of the Triangle, and a board member of the North Carolina Japan Center, and his wife, Yoshiko Iwashima. Also in attendance were Robert Azar, president and CEO of Cary-based Global Medical Technologies Incorporated, and a board member of the North Carolina Japan Center, and North Carolina Secretary of State Protocol Officer Janelle Bowman. Secretary Marshall took the opportunity to recognize David Robinson, the new Honorary Consul General of Japan for North Carolina, of law firm Nexen Pruitt in Raleigh. Terry Foundation donates $16 million to NCSU Veterinary College. A $16 million commitment to the North Carolina State University College of Veterinary Medicine by the Randall B. Terry Charitable Foundation will provide $8 million in funding for student scholarships, more than doubling the college's current scholarship endowment. An additional $3 million is allocated for research, also doubling the amount of internal funding available. The remaining $5 million will be used to support faculty through endowed professorships, according to the college. Terry, the late co-publisher of the High Point Enterprise, was a lover of animals and particularly golden retrievers, according to various accounts of his life. According to NC State, he owned 9 and named them after figures in Greek mythology: Achilles, Ajax, Apollo, Athena, Diana, Nike, Rumor, Venus, and Zeus. Though Terry did not graduate from NC State, the care his beloved golden retrievers received at the college contributed to his philanthropic dedication to the program. The Randall B. Terry Companion Animal Veterinary Medical Center is named for Terry after the foundation donated $20 million toward its construction in 2005. The foundation has donated a total of $47 million to the College of Veterinary Medicine. Heron's Pastry Chef wins Beard Foundation grant for mentorship. Katrin Sidnor, pastry chef at Heron's Restaurant at the Umstead Hotel and Spa in Cary, is one of 8 recipients of the James Beard Foundation's 2015 Women in Culinary Leadership Grants. The grant will enable Sidnor to complete a 6-month mentorship program overseen by Chef Anthony Lamas of Ceviche Restaurant in Louisville. Each grantee will also have an opportunity to work alongside guest chefs at the historic James Beard House in New York City for 1 week. This mentorship program is a part of the foundation's overall mission to help launch the careers of the next generation of chefs and restaurateurs, says Susan Ungaro, president of the James Beard Foundation, in a release. As of 2015, the foundation has awarded more than $5.6 million in financial aid to 1,750 culinary students. Callaway retires from exhibit business. After a 40-year career in the trade show industry, Raleigh's Lana Callaway is retiring and handing over the reins of her company, Exhibit Resources, to another Raleigh firm. Callaway, who began Exhibit Resources some 25 years ago, says her clients will move over to Zigzibit, which designs, builds, and rents custom exhibits. Jake Merzigian, Zigzibit owner, tells Biz that Exhibit's 8 workers have moved to the company's old Wake Forest Road location that employs about 40. No money was exchanged in the deal. Callaway, one of the first well-established women-owned Triangle business owners, has won numerous business awards and sits on several local nonprofit boards. Parker joins Triangle Bank of America team. Virginia Parker is on the move again. With a little more than a year as a senior vice president of the Triangle United Way, Parker has taken a job at Bank of America. Biz was told Parker joins Bank of America as senior vice president, Triangle Market Manager, working closely with Carrie Stoltz, Triangle Market President. Parker will coordinate sponsorship and corporate social responsibility initiatives, including philanthropy and volunteering efforts. And finally, NCMA celebrates 20 years with Wheeler at the helm. The North Carolina Museum of Art recently held a special dinner to celebrate the 20th anniversary of its CEO Lawrence Wheeler, donor Ann Goodnight, gave a poignant speech about Wheeler's accomplishments. The Goodnights have donated several of their own art pieces to the museum over the years, including Claude Monet's Waves at the Manaport. Other attendees included former Governor Beverly Perdue, former Quintile COO John Ratliff, former UNC Chapel Hill basketball player Charlie McNary, and Wybrick Robbins' Larry Robbins. And now we turn to the reporter pages in the Triangle Business Journal. And first, we have On Real Estate by Amanda Hoyle. The first headline, Sources, All Scripts and Talks to Move, Build Tower at North Hills. Real estate sources are saying that All Scripts Healthcare is close to signing a big office lease deal to move all of its people and operations out of the Forum Office Park in North Raleigh to a higher-profile 18-story building at North Hills. John Kane, chief executive of North Hills Development Company, Kane Realty Corporation, says no lease with Allscripts has been signed, and he denied that they were close to any kind of an agreement. Allscripts spokesperson, Conchetta DeFranco, concurred in an email response, Allscripts has not signed a new lease anywhere in Raleigh. But sources say the healthcare information technology company, which employs more than 1,260 people in Raleigh, has been considering either a deal to renew a contract for office space that it occupies in three buildings at the Forum, or to relocate elsewhere in the Raleigh area. Allscripts, which is based in Chicago, in 2013 restructured its lease for 304,622 square feet in the Forum, 2, Forum 4, and Forum 5 buildings on Six Forks Road, according to Wake County records. City of Raleigh approves Dick's deal. North Carolina Senate drops opposition. A state Senate bill that could have delayed or blocked the pending $52 million sale of the Dorothea Dix campus to the City of Raleigh has been dropped. The three co-sponsors of Senate Bill 705 had stated they were most concerned that the negotiated purchase price with the city was too low, that the proceeds would not be earmarked to benefit North Carolinians with mental illness, and that no plan was in place for the relocation of the State Department of Health and Human Services from the site. After discussions with Governor Pat McCrory, however, Senate Pro Tem Phil Berger announced April 27 that the bill's sponsors' concerns had been addressed and they would no longer pursue the opposition bill. The Council of State is set to vote on the agreement at its May 5 meeting, which would be the final step in the 300-acre land transfer deal. The Raleigh City Council on April 24 voted to approve the terms of the purchase agreement, including sharing the cost of cleanup for contaminated soil on the property. Construction begins at the Cardinal at North Hills. Construction crews at the site of the Cardinal at North Hills, a 225-unit senior living community next to Midtown Park at North Hills, have started going vertical on the residential structures. The first units at the Cardinal are slated to be ready for move-in by summer 2016. Developers and future residents of the project held a groundbreaking ceremony for the project in April 2014. The Cardinal, a development of Kisco Senior Living, will be the first continuing care retirement community in Raleigh that will be available without a buy-in payment. The community will have 225 independent and assisted living units. To date, 148 of the independent units, or 90%, have already been reserved by future residents. Crabtree Valley Mall to add parking, retail. The owners of Crabtree Valley Mall are finalizing plans to add several new retail shops and a new parking deck ramp to the front of the mall property. The project will add 5 or 6 new retail spaces of about 2,000 square feet each, all of which will be facing Glenwood Avenue, between the mall's front entrance and the Starbucks coffee shop on the east side, and the Sears department store to the west. The new parking deck ramp near Sears, also known as the Blue Deck, will add about 20 more parking spaces and help ease traffic flow. Charles Lanier, director of leasing for the mall's management company, Plaza Associates, says they are being choosy about which retailers will be selected for the new spaces, but none will be restaurants. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Technology page written by Lauren Onasorge. The first headline, Cree banks on new lighting technology. Cree is banking on a new technology to brighten both its numbers and your office building. Tom Hines, Durham-based product portfolio manager for lighting at Cree, says the innovation, which was partially developed at the Durham campus, is game-changing. We're doing things a little differently, he says, explaining that the technology, dubbed WaveMax technology, efficiently distributes light differently than the office lights you're used to. Traditional lighting, he explains, operates without a lot of control or precision about where that light goes. Cree's new technology allows it to shape the light coming out of the fixture, resulting in a more uniform lighting environment, one applicable in everything from office environments to parking garages. Norbert Hiller, Cree's executive vice president for lighting, says the new technology enables, quote, our most intelligent light yet, unquote. The first interior LED with the technology is the Cree LN series. The outdoor component is the IG series LED parking garage luminaire. And Cree is banking that the technology will reinvigorate growth, despite Cree CEO Chuck Swoboda's repeated statements that the brand is strengthening. It's been seeing decreases in LED revenue. The company reported $410 million in third quarter revenue and saw a 23% year-over-year LED revenue increase. Cree recently made the decision to outsource some of its manufacturing and to slow production to accommodate its roughly 90 days worth of inventory. The company wouldn't be specific about its manufacturing plans for new lamps using the technology. Blackstone boosts Triangle mentoring efforts. Judith Cohn, interim executive director of the Blackstone Entrepreneurs Network, says the startup mentoring program is doubling down on the Triangle and specifically HQ Raleigh. Cohn, managing partner for the effort since the coalition first partnered with area universities to boost entrepreneurship 3 years ago, says Blackstone is in the process of formalizing relationships across the region, starting with downtown Raleigh's co-working hub. She says to expect future announcements at Launch Chapel Hill, Duke University, American Underground, and First Flight Venture Center. The HQ partnership has been expanded to provide more support for Raleigh entrepreneurs. For its part in the partnership, HQ Raleigh will provide unlimited membership to 7 Blackstone entrepreneurs in residence, as well as 7 select network companies. The entrepreneurs in residence will mentor and provide their connections, and leaders at Blackstone's network will participate on both the HQ Raleigh Advisory Board and the Innovate Raleigh Advisory Board. Additionally, the network will hold advisory meetings with HQ startups throughout the year and provide office hours and pitch feedback. And in a section called He Said It, there's a quote from Mark Grinberg, Umicore CEO, responding to a question about the worst-case scenario in a patent infringement suit BASF filed earlier this year. The suit surrounds substances used to make the lithium-ion batteries used in everything from smartphones to electric vehicles, and its outcome could impact Raleigh as Umicore houses its North American headquarters on Glenwood Avenue. The quote is, there is no case and there is no worst-case scenario to be considered. And in a section called Deal Roundup, River Cities Capital leads $12 million round for Boston firm. River Cities Capital Funds, a venture firm with dual operations in Cincinnati and Raleigh, just led a $12 million round for Boston-based Advanced Practice Strategies, APS, which provides an e-learning and talent management platform for clinicians, raised the cash from River Cities and Summation Health Ventures, the investment arm of Memorial Care Health System, and Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. Ascension Ventures also participated. Raleigh-based partner Rick Vandeveen scored a board seat in the deal. Duke University snags $9.75 million for a big data project. Duke University just scored $9.75 million to tackle big data. The cash funds its information initiative launched in 2013 that aims to make sense of big data and get a feel for how it can solve real-world problems. Vadim lands million-dollar Army contract. Raleigh-based Vadim just scored a $1 million contract from the U.S. Army Research Laboratory to design, build, and demonstrate a radar system for ground vehicles to detect buried explosive devices on the battlefield. PhotoSwipe photo sharing app raises $470,000. PhotoSwipe, a Raleigh-based photo share app, just added $470,000 to its coffer, according to a securities filing. The company, which incorporated just last year, has raised about $800,000 so far. And we have one article in a page on banking by Lauren Onosorge also. The headline, Why Yatkin CEO is Having Lots of Discussions. If history is to be believed, Raleigh's Yatkin Bank could be 6 months away from its next deal. Via a candid post-earnings conversation, Yatkin CEO Scott Custer talked about both deal flow and the latest restructuring, a move that, according to securities filings, means branch closures and job cuts. On the next deal, Custer says part of his job is keeping conversations going with potential partners, and that he's always eyeing potential opportunities, and that means acquisitions. I would say that I have lots of discussions and we're certainly interested in continuing to grow the company, he says, adding that there's nothing imminent in the works, but the bank's pattern has been a deal nearly every 15 months. And the Yatkin deal with Raleigh's Vantage South Bank closed in July. It's kind of hard to predict these things using a calendar, Custer says. They really are much more as the situation presents itself and the stars line up, and you find a partner that has similar views than you do, and it just works out. On the branch closures, Custer wouldn't be specific about where the closures would happen. I really can't right now because we're still in the process of some customer notifications that have not been completed, he says. And the company is still growing, despite the cuts, he notes, pointing to the new branch opening soon in Raleigh. On the job cuts, nor would Custer be specific as to how many job cuts to expect. He did say the total is likely in the mid-20s range. They are primarily staff and back-office positions that have largely been deemed to be redundant once we got through to the other side of the integration, he says. And with this article, there's a section called By the Numbers. $9.6 million net income in first quarter. $1.24 million net income 1 year ago. $38.2 million loan revenue, more than double 1 year ago. And $8.84 million fee revenue, more than 75.7% year-over-year increase. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Healthcare page written by Jason DeBrun. The first headline, Durham and Wake at risk of geriatric physician shortage. An impending doctor shortage has been widely reported in recent years, and now a Duke University professor has raised alarm, especially as it relates to elder care. We are not prepared as a nation. We are facing a crisis, says Dr. Heather Whitson, associate professor of medicine at the Duke University School of Medicine, in a U.S. News and World Report. Our current healthcare system is ill-equipped to provide the optimal care experience for patients with multiple chronic conditions or with functional limitations and disabilities. Providing health care to an aging population will be especially important in Wake and Durham counties. Consider that the Wake County population of those 65 years and older is expected to increase 149% to 246,811 by 2034. During the same time, the overall population will increase by 40%, and the median age will increase from 36 years to nearly 41 years, according to projections from the North Carolina Office of State Budget Management. A group of nurses say that relaxing North Carolina oversight regulations on advanced practice nurses would help alleviate the physician shortage, but doctors fear changing regulations could affect patient safety. In Durham County, the aging population growth isn't as disparate as the overall population, but it is still stark. Those 65 years and older will more than double to 64,861 by 2034, while the overall population will increase by 35%, according to OSBM. Contributing to the shortage is the financial reality that geriatric specialists aren't paid as much as other specialties because they rely so much on Medicare reimbursements. Geriatrics is the only subspecialty where physicians can expect to ultimately earn less, even though they did extra years of training, Whitson says in the U.S. News report. We need a restructuring of the reimbursement system so there isn't a financial disincentive to go down this career path. And along with this article, there's a by-the-numbers section. 149% projected Wake County population increase by 2034 of those 65 years and older to 246,811, compared with a 40% increase for the overall population, and 35% projected Durham County population increase by 2034 of those 65 years and older to 64,861. UNC Healthcare quadruples budgeted operating income. A smoothly integrated health record system contributed to UNC Healthcare's pace of reporting operating income of nearly four times the budget for this fiscal year. At the beginning of the year, the healthcare system, based in Chapel Hill, but with operations throughout North Carolina, planned an operating income of about $21 million through 8 months. The latest financial reports show the hospital system recorded operating income of nearly $82 million through the first 8 months. All major health systems in the Triangle have implemented a health record system, from Wisconsin-based health IT company Epic. UNC Healthcare System spokeswoman Karen McCall says the implementation has happened more smoothly than expected, contributing to the strong operating income line. Although total patient days came in nearly exactly in line with budget, total discharges were about 4% below expected. That means UNC Healthcare is seeing fewer total patients than expected, but each patient is staying in the system longer, on average. Surgery cases were also below budget and only slightly above the same time last year. Hospitals have been locked in a political battle that will rage on this summer. Private physician groups want North Carolina health care regulations changed so they can more easily open and operate independent surgery centers, something they argue will lower costs. The North Carolina Hospital Association argues it needs those surgeries to cover expenses for areas like emergency preparedness that run up costs but for which they are not always reimbursed. Hospital critics point to strong financial reports, like the one from UNC Healthcare, to argue that hospitals should not cry poor, but hospitals rightly counter that the financial performance of many rural hospitals is far less stellar. One of the bills to change hospital regulations, known as Certificate of Need laws, would apply only to counties with populations of 100,000 or more. Bill's sponsor, Marilyn Avila, a Wake County Republican, argues this will introduce more competition in strong healthcare markets while still protecting essential services in rural healthcare markets. Looking more closely at the UNC healthcare numbers shows that the system largely has UNC hospitals in Chapel Hill to thank for the performance. The system had budgeted operating income of $58 million from the hospital, but recorded $116 million through 8 months. Higher than expected revenue for the system also contributed to the operating income. Through 8 months, the healthcare system topped $2 billion in total operating revenue, close to $100 million more than budgeted. And finally, in a by-the-numbers section, UNC healthcare performance. Through 8 months of the UNC healthcare fiscal year, which runs July through June, the hospital system has posted strong financial results, largely on the back of a strong performance from the main hospital in Chapel Hill. The net operating revenue for UNC Healthcare has a variance of $98 million, a 5% increase, and the net operating revenue for UNC Hospitals has a variance of $65 million for a 7% increase. And now we turn to the On Pharma page, also written by Jason DeBruin. The first headline, Duke spinout loses more than $500 million in market value, 72% of company value. Aerie Pharmaceuticals, that's spelled A-E-R-I-E, a drug developer with roots in Duke University, lost more than $500 million in market value after disappointing trial results, but vowed to push forward. Aerie CEO Vincent Anito kept his sights forward and told investors to still believe in the company's experimental drugs for eye treatments. As you can imagine, the last couple days have not been fun, Anito said on a conference call after the company reported disappointing results from a trial testing the drug called Ropressa. We are planning ahead, Anito said. We missed on this first one, but we had some pretty good data. We do think we have an efficacious drug here. Importantly, Aerie also has money. The company has nearly $180 million in cash, with a burn rate of about $60 million. Anito says, we have quite a few years left of cash, so we can still execute our current plans. Before applying with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to bring a new drug to market, developers have to test the drug to make sure it's safe and performs better than existing treatments. A trial testing Ropressa, which Aerie titled Rocket One, showed that the drug did not perform as well in glaucoma patients as the existing treatment, Timolol. However, data from the trial show that it was a near miss, so there is still hope for the company. And also a graph along with this article shows the closing price for Aerie Pharmaceuticals by day from Yahoo Finance. Shows on April 20, the closing price was $34.98, but by April 27th, the closing price, $10.70. And finally, under the headline Public Offering, $34.5 million. Raleigh drug developer Nephrogenics Incorporated plans to go to the public markets to raise up to $34.5 million in a secondary public offering. The company plans to use the money to increase the clinical sites at which it will test Peridorin, its experimental drug under development for the treatment of diabetic nephropathy, a common complication of diabetes, and in cases of acute kidney injury. Specifically, Nephrogenics wants to increase its Phase 3 clinical trial of Peridorin, 150 sites across the globe. In addition, Nephrogenics would use money to file an investigational new drug application, the regulatory process through the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to bring a new drug to market. And in the Triangle Business Journal, we now turn to the On Transportation page, written by Jeff Jeffrey. The first headline, RDU, SB 541 could cause losses. Airport opposes parts of bill to regulate ride-sharing companies. A bill in the North Carolina Senate to regulate ride-sharing companies like Uber and Lyft may threaten Raleigh-Durham International Airport's ability to collect fees from all commercial vehicles that offer passengers a ride to and from the airport, including taxis. That could cost RDU more than $500,000 each year, according to the airport's budget. Senate Bill 541 would require drivers working for so-called transportation network companies, which allow users to arrange for transportation services via online applications, to obtain state-for-hire licenses, $1 million in liability insurance, and to pass criminal background checks. If passed, the bill would go into effect July 1. RDU spokeswoman Mindy Hamlin says the airport supports those aspects of the bill. However, Hamlin says another provision to block cities and airports from regulating transportation network companies would inadvertently bar RDU from regulating other transportation services. The airport receives federal grant assurances which require us to say we will not discriminate against companies that are similar in nature, Hamlin says. If we cannot manage companies like TNCs, that could affect our ability to manage other companies like taxis, limousines, car shuttle services, and other commercial vehicles. RDU requires commercial vehicles making use of its curbs to install an AVI transponder, which tracks their trips and charges a $1 to $2 fee each time they visit the airport, depending on the type of vehicle. For most commercial vehicles, the transponder costs between $25 and $50 to install, plus a $125 annual fee. According to RDU's budget, the airport expects to collect $313,000 from commercial vehicles over the next year. Taxis adhere to a slightly different fee structure and are expected to generate $210,880 in revenue during the 2015 fiscal year. Hamlin says the transponders and fees help the airport manage its curbs and protect passengers, but she says it's too early to tell what the monetary impact would be if SB 541 is passed in its current form. Ride-sharing companies like Uber and Lyft have bristled at the airport's efforts to regulate their drivers, saying they offer a different type of service and should be regulated accordingly. Taylor Bennett, an Uber spokesman, says his company supports SB 541 because the state should set uniform standards rather than forcing ride-sharing companies to comply with different regulations in different jurisdictions. "We're certainly willing to pay our fair share when it comes to airport access," Bennett says. "We look forward to reaching the right agreement with airports like RDU." Bennett says Uber has negotiated payment agreements in other parts of the country, some of which require the company to pay an annual fee. Others require the company to pay per trip. "We want what's best for our drivers and what the market demands," Bennett says. In the meantime, RDU is continuing to ticket Uber and Lyft drivers who have not installed AVI transponders or who do not meet other requirements, Hamlin says. About 800 tickets have been issued to date. The $50 tickets are paid to the airport authority. "Our concern is that many of these drivers are failing to comply with state law, which requires for-hire license plates, liability insurance, and background checks," Hamlin says. "Some Uber and Lyft drivers have opted to go through RDU's permit process to avoid being ticketed." Hamlin says 38 drivers have been issued permits at this time. Old Terminal 1 demolition contract awarded. The final phase of Raleigh-Durham International Airport's Terminal 1 reconstruction project is underway, tearing down what's left of the old building. The demolition process will begin in early 2016, says RDU spokeswoman Mindy Hamlin. The project is expected to cost between $6 million and $7 million. Terminal 1 reopened last summer after a $68 million renovation and is primarily occupied by Southwest Airlines. Raleigh-based architecture and engineering firm Clark Nexen is handling the design portion of the project. Under the $972,137 contract it was awarded in February, the RDU board approved Balfour Beatty Construction's $199,635 contract for the project during its most recent meeting in March. The airport is also in the process of developing a long-term master plan, which will include a number of infrastructure projects designed to carry RDU through the next 25 years. Hamlin said RDU's board has authorized airport officials to begin negotiating with Rokando and Associates Incorporated to act as a consultant on developing the master plan. The planning phase of the master plan is expected to be completed by early 2017. And there is a by-the-numbers section titled Durham's East End Connector. After decades of failed attempts, state and local officials broke ground on Durham's East End Connector. The project aims to alleviate traffic in downtown Durham by providing a link to four major routes to the area, in the area, including I-85, US 70, NC 147, and I-40. 1959, the year the project was first proposed. 2019, the year the East End Connector is expected to be completed. We just have to wait it out, says Durham County Board of Commissioners Chairman Michael Page. 3.9, the length of the East End Connector in miles. $142 million, the estimated cost of the project. And finally, there's also a listing of park spending, the top 15 per capita spending on parks and recreation. Number one is Washington, D.C. at 346. Seattle is number two at 298. Arlington, Virginia, third at $249. Four, Minneapolis, $230. Five, San Francisco, $217. And Raleigh, North Carolina, comes in at number 14 on the list, $155. And for our remaining minutes with the Triangle Business Journal, we'll move to the Viewpoint page. And first, the guest column. The guest column is written by Brian Balfour, who is a policy director of the Civitas Institute in Raleigh. The headline on his guest column is, Film Subsidies Distort Free Market Economy. The glitz and glamour of movie and television production in North Carolina apparently is too tempting for several legislators to pass up. Unfortunately, they're willing to use your tax dollars to bribe more Hollywood big shots to come to the Tar Heel State. For years, North Carolina had a generous state tax credit for qualifying film production expenses. This program amounted to doling out political privilege to a politically connected industry, creating unfair advantages for film production and distorting the state's arrangement of productive resources compared to what they would be in a free market. This tax credit was allowed to expire in December, but the 2014 to 2015 state budget included a $10 million grant program to offset a portion of expenses. But to the supporters of House Bill 171 and its equivalent, Senate Bill 193, $10 million in taxpayer handouts to Hollywood fat cats is not enough. The legislation would expand the annual amount of the fund to a whopping $66 million. Of course, every penny of the $66 million would first be taken from taxpayers across the state. Legislators will claim they are creating jobs with the handouts, but that's nonsense. Every job supported by taxpayer handouts hurts job growth and investment elsewhere in the economy. Government cannot create jobs, it can merely shift around the mix of jobs. Such exertion over the control of the state's productive resources, including labor, is a form of top-down central planning, period. Moreover, intrusive meddling into the economy invites more political patronage, as other special interest groups see willingness to promote corporate welfare for one industry as a sign that state legislators may grant them political privilege as well. As a result, the halls of the state capitol swell with lobbyists. And also, we'll read as much as we can of the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Help Me Extract Bright Side of Company Mergers. The rags-to-riches story of how Bronto Software's first two employees, Joe Colopy and Chaz Felix, started, built, and sold the company for $200 million, offers a glimpse of two mid-40s do-gooders who successfully nurtured what they believe was a company that one day would corral the world's biggest retailers into the e-commerce marketing world. They went at it for 13 years, and just a few days ago, the duo hit pay dirt. California's NetSuite concluded that Bronto possesses a secret sauce that makes its pasta better. That's great, but what about the triangle? Once again, similar to scores of companies before, we have spawned two very rich individuals along with a handful of workers who are a few hundred thousand dollars wealthier. In the short run, nothing is expected to change, especially for the people who are tied to the employment contracts written up by the new bosses. Then what? What happens to the 250-odd people employed by the company who come to work every morning, eat lunch at those quaint restaurants off Blackwell Street in Durham, and drink beer in the veranda located in front of Bay 7 at the American Tobacco campus? Colopy, Felix, and NetSuite CEO Zach Nelson are adamant that Bronto plays a pivotal role in NetSuite's future success. Therefore, the company's Durham ops will only grow. Maybe, but we have seen what happens when a big company acquires a smaller counterpart. Cuts are inevitable. Part of the reason why an acquisition works is because there are cost benefits. In Bronto's case, that may even work better, since the company was losing money despite its $200 million valuation. Colopy calls it an accounting issue. But Colopy and Felix's wealth really is not the story. The story really is about why the triangle has difficulty holding on to companies. Are we becoming the place where companies are born to sell? Have we become an incubator city? Now, one may argue similar ecosystems exist in other high-flying southeastern U.S. cities such as Austin, Nashville, and Tampa. Austin has 37 public companies, one Fortune 500. Nashville is home to 30 public companies, five among Fortune 500, and Tampa is home to about 30 publicly traded concerns with four Fortune 500 companies. What about the triangle? We have about 30 public companies and one in the Fortune 500 list, Quintiles. So the numbers are similar, but if you total up the market cap of these public companies in different cities, you come up with a vastly different picture. And we'll have to stop there as we run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.